W.S. Thackeray, I'm back again with Major General C.B. Ware. It's the 16th of July, 1980, and this is a continuation of the previous side.
Okay, I think
we're set now.
We
just
carry on. Did you train with the Germans at all?
We trained user training facilities.
Yeah.
We didn't train with them on any small scale. I mean, we didn't have any exercises against each other in the battalions. The only time we really trained with Germans were in the larger exercises. We had one colossal exercise
in
divisions, and we did one. The Danes weren't very keen on heavy against us, but our exercises straight with Germans were mostly were confined to the higher levels. And, of course, there were signals exercises, an exercise called Shapex, which is still going on, I believe. And of course, there were any number of exercises like that. And the Northern Army Group, a proportion of the staff were German.
How did you find them as soldiers, if you will, or as staff officers, or did you have anything to do with them to any extent?
I always found a German soldier is a very proficient guy. Mm-hmm. They're excellent soldiers. I don't think the army at the time we were there wasn't. I don't think it's up to the standard of their pre-war army.
No, they had quite a bit to do with a democratic army at that time.
It's very difficult. Armies are not democratic, in my opinion.
No, I agree. But nevertheless, that was one of their crosses they had to bear, wasn't it, at that point, to some extent?
Their officers, I like most of their officers. They're easy to deal with. And mm-hmm. Their most proficient ones, as usual, were Prussians. It was very interesting with the brigade, of course. It was had a lot of interesting people coming to stay. And one of the better Germans was General Speidel.
Oh, yeah. Who, of course, had a good war career, hadn't he?
Oh, very. Had the right, and he was a very interesting person, too. Mm-hmm. You could talk to him, and he would bring him, of course, and he was Dr. General Speidel. But came with NATO, and of course, and the Germans you did see were all very much on the same side.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Yes, you could talk to them with the war. Most of them were getting on then, 1960, 61, that's 20 years after the start of the war. Their higher commanders were during the war, mostly gone. Speidel was one of the few really high ones during the war that were left. But when you came to COs and so on here, and most of the COs just got into the war very late on. And of course, below that, while they were the product of the new army.
As ours were too, I suppose, to some extent, even though it was different. I mean, as far as wartime experience goes. Isn't it?
But our brigade, that brigade is first class of ours. I think they're the finest troops. You used to get a lot of congratulations on everything you did, and as usual, you sometimes wonder perhaps this is all justified, but it wasn't really international. It was a first class brigade. And, everybody was beautifully trained. I mean, no reason why it shouldn't have been. It was rotation with by units, so a unit came in and had been together, and it was trained into the ground, and you trained it into the ground properly when you got it there. We had everything in the way of equipment that was coming, everything that was well paid comparatively. It was well supplied, barracks were good. It was a terrific morale in that brigade. Mm-hmm. We worked out of it, of course, and that was one reason why it was always
good, yeah.
But we did sometimes used to wonder, whenever anybody comes in, we say, Walsh and I used to, here he is, I said, whoever takes whoever's job has to do one more exercise. Sometimes you wonder if you've done too many, but it was a busy year there. But it was...
Was it larger in those days than it is now?
It was 6,500.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 6,500.
You had 6,500.
Oh, yes. Indeed.
Yeah, you were up to strength.
And when the Berlin Wall was built, aside from the fact that, that there had been a war, I think both the Russians and ourselves were so busy maneuvering against each other from the north, northeast corner of Germany, I'm not sure anybody had enough strength left for the war. it was maneuver time, but it was interesting watching that. We didn't watch the wall go up, and at that point, but I got my first reinforcements, which smarted me up considerably. They came over, I think, got 1,500 men from the, I suppose, the alert. The reinforcements arrived over, like bang. Very encouraging. I don't think we could do that these days. We haven't got the troops.
Yeah, maybe not.
But that's the sort of thing it was. You knew you had everything, and it was as a divisional commander who we worked closely with in operations said that very, very independent Canadian brigade.
Yeah. Yes, I imagine sometimes, as usual, we were a thorn in somebody's side.
Well, it was very, it was a very welcome brigade to have around because, it, as I say, if you get something that is up to strength and equipment such as it is, and I mean, even in my time, we got a helicopter squadron. Well, that was 1962, admittedly, but I was gratified and pleased when it came.
No, I suppose they were all professionals, too, or you were all professionals, distinct from
Americans
and Brits who were still...
Mark, we worked, sometimes we, the Americans worked stupidly, I think, often, you know, the general gets down there at 7:30 in the morning, which means the colonel who's briefed the brigadier is probably down there around 5 o'clock, and which means all intelligence people are down earlier, by the time noon comes along, practically had the course.
Yeah, right.
Whereas Canadians, I think, worked hard, but I think we worked more productively than most people. I think the British probably thought we exercised a bit much.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
But it was just a thoroughly well-trained brigade. We used to have our practice, you know, quick train exercises, get to our battle positions, and the worst thing that could happen to you was if you called one of these exercises, nobody ever knew it took the brigade train. You just said the brigade major and said, go. And the worst thing that could happen was if you called one on a Saturday night in the middle of a hockey game. You'd catch all those that were at the hockey game.
That wasn't too popular at times.
We never took more than 2 hours, I don't think, to be in position. And the battle positions were, on the operational roles were into the ground. It was an interesting time in the, it was the time we got the Honest Johns to, rather to my embarrassment in some respects, the Americans gave us the latest model, which was better than the ones they had. And of course, they refused to have nuclear warheads for them. But in the meantime, we had storerooms for nuclear warheads. We built a building for the Americans. We had practice rounds, and every country in NATO used to come to see us fire off our 4 practice rounds because the Americans didn't have as good a weapon. Everybody crowded around for our practice firing. We could have afforded more.
You only had 4, though.
I think it was about 4. Yeah. We may have had 8, but it was a pretty quick effort. But
how was it we never went to the Nike weapon?
We used to, it was discussed that Nike weapons had nuclear tips, too.
And we could
it was Pearson, wasn't it, or was it Diefenbaker?
Well,
Diefenbaker.
Who wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, Diefenbaker wouldn't have anything to do with it. They should never let us have the, you know, for Doug Harkness spoiler, but they should never let us have the weapon unless we use it. But, of course, it wouldn't have deterred you if there had been a war. But,
Well, I mean, the reason I threw the Nike in there because I didn't realize that we had people trained to use Nike, even if
We had our own. We sent when I was DGMG, we sent people by the score down to the States. We were getting Nike then. Memory fails me where it fell by the wayside, but I presume it was even when Tony Bailey was director of artillery, we were supposed to be getting Nike.
Because I had a cousin who went to Texas on that, and he spent 2 years with a British Nike regiment. And knew it backwards, of course, and then all his information was never put to any use, of course. And I just, I think that's a no. But I suppose it was the nuclear thing that scared them off, because Nike only probably came nuclear, I think.
Well, I think at that point it did.
Yeah. Well, there
when
we are.
First started. But
it's always been a little bit of a soft point with us, I think.
Well, it was a very sore point with the Americans, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can bet it was. Yeah.
Very sore point with the gate commander, too.
Yeah. No, one doesn't like to be put in a position of having to apologize or to explain embarrassing situations to foreigners.
I remember. God, it's so long ago now, I've forgotten. Our great member from out here, Harold Winch, was it?
Oh, yeah.
He used to come over, a tame reporter from the Vancouver Sun, I remember him. Well, briefed all the questions to ask. Nuclear-wise, we were very...
God, I bet you had to be awfully careful what you said. A little bad, eh?
Oh, yeah, we did at that point.
Yeah.
Of course it was. We never dreamed we wouldn't get the mine. Never crossed the mind. Took Doug Harkness' resignation, that was the end of the Diefenbaker government, really, wasn't it? Like you, that was a little later, but...
Well, something like that would have happened before the Diefenbaker government was in bad shape anyway, but it was going to... It was, you know, that was the thing that probably pulled the pin eventually.
Have you had Finn Clark on here? I'm sure you have.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he can cover all that.
Yeah. I haven't done. We do have him on tape.
He was at CGS at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very interesting time, I'm sure. Okay, so at the end of your two-year tour, what happened then?
The end of two-year tour is Major General and left command of the National Defense Club.
Oh, yeah. For how many?
4 years.
Wait,
could have gone on forever, as far as I was concerned.
You really enjoyed that?
Oh, yeah, that was a great one. That is the finest college as far as curriculum and things. I'm afraid it's never got its just due in this country, I don't think.
Is it not? Has it not been widened, the input of students been widened to some extent? They take in industrial industry now and politicians?
Oh, we always did.
Oh, did you all? Oh,
oh yes, yeah.
And you had some trouble getting enough people in the industry, point of.
We had trouble getting industry. Well, my young nephew was a case in point. He was presumed to be heading for the top of Union Carbide, but he was offered the thing, but it's the old stuff. A lot of these, if they're headed for the top, often they don't want to go. The company doesn't want to let them go for a year. They'll let them go for 2 months. They don't want to let them go for a year. The best company really was a fellow, Harry Beck. He was president of DuPont. And, he put people in and said, boy, a couple I've had back then. Gary McCoy paid off 10 times over. Bell Canada were fairly good. Only one There was one there one year, and I think they only produced once. One of the vice presidents now. And, I imagine your brother is working the hell out of them. He's Financial Times, Don Eisenhower. His father was P.G. Sly Patrick.
Oh, really?
Don is now vice president. That is your brother. You know, it's your cousin.
Cousin.
My God, he certainly turned that company upside down, didn't he?
Yeah, he sure has.
Done well with it. Yeah. But Imperial Oil, they were usually fairly good. But the people that took the greatest advantage of it were American and British. The British, for example, the 4 years I was there, apart from one fellow who fell ill and had to be retired, they'd send people over as colonels, they'd promote them brigadier halfway through, and within a year, they were major generals. That's what the British thought of it. The Americans, very much the same, but we weren't always that good in the Canadian side.
It was funny, eh? Very odd.
Yeah. Very sad, right?
Did you, at that point, had, I guess, as commandant, did you live in Roselawn?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah. 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 They bought it by then. I wonder when. Yeah. I'm sure when they bought that.
They bought it that year that Leo Brennan and I were at Staff College. Bess and I were living in an old house which had been turned into apartments. Our apartment was about the size of this room. But it was just off Union Street, and we used to walk the dogs. In those days, they had dogs. We walked the dogs up to Roselawn, the corner, and around, and we'd say, that poor British general. Because Roselawn had been bought during the war as turned into a quack barracks. And then at the end of the war, of course, it wasn't used. And, well, then when Guy went over to England, well, the swap was that the Canadian Defense College would be started up, and the British had sent a general over here. And so they sent Jock Playfair, who you probably know by reputation, dead now, poor man, but he was a four-star general at Washington, finally. But Jock was sent over, and where to put him? So they put him in Roselawn, and the third guy, they furnished the place after a fashion. The British weren't sending furniture anything.
Oh, good government issue furniture, did it?
So it was government issue furniture, and it was terrible. It was bleak and barren. But we used to look in there and say, that poor British general, that huge place. It was interesting to end up in it.
Yeah, right. I've forgotten. What street was Rosa on now? You know,
it's on Union and College. Union ran parallel to, here we are, what's the lake shore? King Street.
King Street, yeah.
Yeah, King Street was on the lake. Union was up two or three blocks.
Two or three blocks,
parallel,
yeah.
North.
Yeah.
Leading up to the penitentiary.
Yeah.
And Rupert Davies' house was next door. Senator Davies' house. And they turned that into a penitentiary staff college while we were there.
Oh, did they?
Probably at the behest of James Stone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to have a batman who, Willie Mulhern, was commanding the guards at that point. I said, Willie, for God's sake, send me down somebody that can run a house. Do anything. So he sent down a hell of a good fellow from Cape Breton, who, in due course, I guess best trained him how to be a batman. And he was Cape Breton. He thought people were supposed to live this way. I think he brought everybody's breakfast up to bed. and he was great. When he was on the table, he was just talking. And he was absolutely great.
In those days, so, the government allowed you a steward or a batman, didn't you?
Well, we got him. I'm not so sure we were allowed it. Tony Storrs was there before. He had a naval steward. I don't know if I was allowed this one or not, but anyway, I was allowed a driver, so we used to make him turn too. But this good batman, it's paid off. He's now chief petty officer, and he, when I left the army, said, okay, LeBlanc, you well done, faithful soul, that's corporal. I paid him the extra money to, you know, he's only a guardsman. The extra money to, as a lance corporal, under some stripes. But he said, I always wanted to join the Navy. Could you get me in the Navy? And so I, Scruffy O'Brien had him in the Navy in about 2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
But he's risen to the top.
Oh, good for him.
Left here, so.
Yeah. Well, there was good training, I bet.
Good training, yeah, good. But there were very interesting guests at Roselawn. We, of course, had different lecture. I mean, the forum was very much the IDC pattern lecture in the morning, for an hour, so an hour and a half questions, and then in the afternoon was syndicate discussions, studies, papers. I mean, but let's say our lecture is where top flight, especially the Americans. I still see some of them. Professor Pipes, if you saw him on the, Dr. Pipes, if you saw a public broadcasting thing on Russian versus NATO strength on public broadcasting the other night, it was a 2-hour program.
He's the University of Washington?
Duke Middleton. No, he's down at Harvard.
Oh, okay, it's not the right one.
But people like that, some of them are still going strong. Brzezinski never came. Kissinger, I have a very amusing letter from. He wasn't Secretary of State then. You know. Once again, Kennedy years, and Kissinger said, "I'm grateful for the invitation, and I would love to come. But frankly, my slant on American foreign policy, while it might be of interest to you, will not have very much bearing on the subject at the moment." He was definitely out of power after Eisenhower left.
Yeah.
Or I see he was back last night again.
Yeah. He's really still going.
That's a very good book, Bill, in your travels. If you want to get it, on Kissinger and Travels with Henry by Richard Valeriani.
Who was
the White House correspondent during those years. He did most of the tours with him, and very readable, and as far as I know, very true.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, Kissinger's a very bright man.
Well documented.
Oh,
yeah, he was certainly out then with the Democrats.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to say. Anyway, so you, at the end of 4 years, you retired, did you do that, or was that?
Yeah, I retired at the end of 4 years.
Yeah.
Debbie Pierce and I were going to change jobs, I think. But we each got extended. This was heavier years, of course, and then we had a great mass meeting of all the generals in Ottawa, and Hellyer outlined his great plans, and Mobile Command, and everybody, the Ottawa boys showed their charts, and everybody went in to see the chairman, chiefs of staff, not knowing whether they were going to be fired or what was going to happen, and I suppose some did get fired, some left. Debbie and I got extended another year where we were, which of course was just enough to rule out any posting to Washington because we'd both be too old.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. How did you find? Sorry, I say you retired. I guess just right in the beginning of the.
Oh no, Hellyer, he'd been minister for 2 years.
Oh, Hellyer, you were well underway then for this.
Yeah, you know, had him. We had him down to lecture. He used to end up the year. This should have been fitting as the defense minister up there. But you probably have heard more about Hellyer from all these people. But
well, I've heard a good deal, I think. But it's interesting because everybody seems to have a basically the same opinion, but the details change from time to time. Right?
Well, he's a very vain man to start with. Well, he never made a good prime minister.
I don't think so. I would hope not.
I don't think he would have. He was, I think he was rather a good minister of transport, and if this housing thing had got off the ground, he might be better off now. Mm-hmm. Of course, Hellyer told me that, so
Well, shall we just consider that to be just a little suspect, eh?
No, he was politically motivated. I think the forces were the scapegoat. Not the, there was nothing wrong with the horses.
Yeah, well, I really have never been able to discover his motivation for this thing and why in hell he took the time and trouble to do this, except, as I say, political for, except for his own possible aggrandizement.
If you turn off the machine, I'll tell you.
Oh, that's as good as done, by. Yeah, well, that's fine. And but apart from that sort of inner sight and the integration that you came across, the political aspect of it that you were privy to, what did you feel about it now or since? You retired shortly thereafter. Did you really... you appalled by all this sort of thing? What was your...
I knew it couldn't work. Naturally, I was keen on the integration. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't be? I mean, the RMC works beautifully, and Defense Color did, and Royal Road does,
yeah.
And any command set up during the war did, and any command actually since has worked far better. It's a unified command, a rather integrated command, but that's far from unification.
And mm-hmm.
Nonsense. I was quite certain it couldn't work. It was a period of very great turmoil, though, Bill. The thing is, the destroyer captain will go up and command a tank squadron. Some people even went as wild as that.
Yes, indeed, yeah. There.
But the great thing it was supposed to do was to stop duplication. As far as I can make out, even if you take the number of generals, I think it's...
Now there you're talking duplication, by
the way. That's duplication. And
yeah.
Always new headquarters have been set up.
Yeah.
Associated. The only test of a military structure is whether it can function operationally. And I don't think this command setup could function operationally. Well, it didn't function operationally in the FLQ thing, 1970. Mike Dare was one place, and the Army was another.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Mike Dare was, in effect, the Chief of Defense Staff, I would think, for
yeah.
a period.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, I was colonel in the PPCLI, so I saw the troop side. Well, the private soldier was troop to troops, and they're well motivated and kept busy, and they fight for the glory of their section and platoon and company and regiment and so on. They were not affected, but as I've seen it lately, it's affected the officers. I mean, some of it's unification fault, some of it's just plain bad personnel management. But sergeant, for example, this is Bill Hutchison, who I think is in your shop up here somewhere. We had a historical conference with Chris the other day, but he said that there unification came up again, and one of the things the sergeants were, because sergeants are more important than the Army and they are in the Air Force, but everything was brought down instead of things being brought up. And same with corporals. But he said he had a sergeant when he was commanding his battalion of the Patricias in the 60s, and who was a sergeant serving with me in Italy in 1943, and he said he had to tell him that he's still a sergeant, and he didn't get him promoted, but instead of being a platoon sergeant, he was now a section leader, because section commanders, sergeants would be section commanders. And the top platoon sergeant would be the equivalent of a staff sergeant. I don't know what they call it, a master sergeant.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
But he said this is where the rot sort of started hitting battalions, and of course allowing captains to stay until they're 55. Many of the clever ones left, and if they weren't promoted by the time they were 45, or I think it was 45, they had to get out, and the smart ones got out and were well into a second career. And a lot of the not so smart stayed in, and that's very distressing when a regiment only gets one or two captains promoted each year.
And yet, you know, there's so much talk about it being so top heavy, so much, so many people in the higher ranks now, that you think there'll perhaps be more opportunity for the lower ranks to move up, but people are hanging on.
Yeah, and they're hanging on at that level. They go very quickly up to captain. And that's so quickly beyond. However, when you've got a whole generation of them brought up with this thing. And
I understand there were some problems, or has been raised with me, that there's a bit too much cross-posting in the Army. For example, from one infantry regiment to another, for example, where you don't get the continuity of the same spirit.
Well, that's why they came from six regiments down to three, which meant the guards from Black Watch and Queen's Own were knocked out. So.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you keep a regimental system was to come down to three, because they weren't with one battalion. Queen's Own had one battalion, Black Watch and guards, they were all down one battalion, and the others were two and three battalions. And you couldn't keep reinforcing a one-battalion regiment without cross-posting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably sorting itself out now. But it was a terrible blow to have to lose these regiments, although it was takes all kinds and all. I remember when the Black Watch and Queen's Own were formed, my cousin was commander of Queen's Own at that point, and, at least best cousin, and so we've always, and Jim Strachey was a great friend of mine. But the Queen's Own did not want to become regular. They had a colonel of honor, and colonel of the regiment. In fact, it was not Jim Strachey, and who, of course, unfortunately dead, but a great soldier, and a damn good colonel, very sensible person, and well, made a hell of a good stockbroker. But,
yeah.
I think it was Baptist Johnson, I don't even know, but at that time, while the Queen's Own were prided themselves on being Canada's oldest militia regiment, and, that's the way they wanted to be, with a fair amount of logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Watch, on the other hand, were they were delighted, said, "This is a great honor has befallen us," and Buckle Watson, who won.